Hello, I'm Greg Muller, and I'm the instructor for the course, Food Toxicology. When we talk about food toxicology, most of us, either through our own experience or through experience that we've seen in friends or family, can relate to an aspect of food toxicology referred to as food allergy. Food allergies are relatively common in the human population. They range from mildly irritating to somewhat of a nuisance to perhaps in some cases, as you read, life-threatening. What we're going to try to do today is go through a little bit of the background of food allergy. Again, I would caution you, this is not a course in allergy medicine or immune function. What we're going to try to do in the course of this particular lecture is give you a sufficient background so that you're better prepared to understand some of the jargon, some of the basic mechanisms and relationships between food and allergic reaction. Our learning objectives here today, what we're going to try to do is understand the types of adverse food reactions. Adverse food reactions being a collective term. We're going to try to differentiate food allergy and food sensitivity. Our next lecture, we're actually going to start talking about some of these food sensitivities and including some metabolic disorders associated with diet. We're going to try to understand the role of immunoglobulin E, IgE as it's referred to, in allergic reaction. It's one of the key immune mediators in allergy. We're going to try to explore the types of IgE and non-IgE mediated food allergy, okay, some of the little pathways. Again, we're only going to go kind of in a superficial way in terms of trying to review some of this, but at least enough to give you a good sense of the relationship of food and allergy. We're going to try as well summarize the series of events associated with an allergic reaction. Again, some of those can be life-threatening. We're going to try to examine some of the symptoms of allergic reaction, including food and systemic anaphylaxis. Many of us have heard the term anaphylaxis or anaphylactic shock. We'll talk about that in its presentation as an allergic response. We'll try as well to summarize the some of the approaches that clinical medicine has in terms of diagnosing food allergy. And then we'll try to survey, in a very broad way, some common food allergens, the top 10 or so, give you an idea of some of the foods and food substances that are of most concern in relationship to food allergy. Well, in terms of adverse reactions to food, many of us have them. 30% of the population here in the United States report that a family member has some sort of food allergy. Quite often this is observed in children, and so we see it intimately in our family lives. The actual percentage does vary, and it crosses the threshold from allergy to sensitivity to food adversity, where you just don't like a particular food and you have a physiological reaction to that dislike. There is a tremendous difference in terms of subpopulations and ethnic groups, racial backgrounds, where food sensitivity and perhaps even metabolic disorders play a strong role in adverse reactions to food. Now, some of these common allergies and food groups include cow's milk, crustacea, lobster, or shrimp allergies, eggs in the albumin protein, fish in terms of some of the components associated with fish and the metabolic products of fish and the bacteria on fish. Peanut allergy is one that is reported quite often in the news because of the violence, perhaps, of some of the outcomes of peanut allergy. Soybean allergy, tree nut allergies of a variety, and wheat allergy, and we'll talk a little bit about gluten-type allergies or celiac disease. Adverse food reactions can be termed as allergies, sensitivities, or intolerance. These are general terms that can be applied to almost any clinically abnormal response to food or food additives. One of the concerns, for instance, that we see in biotechnology when we are changing the components, and sometimes these are protein components associated with a food product, a commodity perhaps, there is some great concern that these new changes in proteins, new proteins appearing in food, are going to elicit an allergic reaction. We'll do an entire lecture here in food toxicology associated with the relationship between food and biotechnology. And in this lecture, what we'll try and do is explore how we review the potential for allergenicity in the products of biotechnology. Some of the symptoms across adverse food reactions are similar in terms of sensitivity versus allergy. And so we try to partition them, but I want you all to recognize that there is a crossover in terms of the absolute sort of pathway of these particular disease manifestations. Some of the types of adverse food reactions, if we go through this list, we have allergy, we have non-immune anaphylaxis or anaphylactoid sort of responses. We have intolerance, food intolerance. We have metabolic disorders where perhaps the subject is missing a particular enzyme and therefore they're sensitized to that particular component of food. We have idiosyncratic responses, which are somewhat unique to individuals, and sometimes those can be drawn among racial or family backgrounds in terms of heritable changes. They aren't necessarily classic in terms of their presentation across broad segments of society. We have drug interactions or pharmacological food reactions. Most of us at some point have taken a pharmaceutical, a drug, and have read on the label, do not consume with a certain sort of food product because of the potential for an interaction. Sometimes that can be an interaction that actually decreases the capacity of the drug to have its positive effect. If you take a penicillin type drug, they warn you not to drink milk products or have milk products, dairy products, and that has a lot to do with the calcium and the calcium binding capacity of penicillin type chemicals. As well, one of the final types of adverse food reactions is overt toxicity, where a particular chemical in the food has a direct toxic impact. In other words, there is a chemical reaction and a disease manifestation in toxicosis. Now, some of these food sensitivities and allergies can be categorized as either food-true allergies, where you have an activation of the immune system. We have some food sensitivities, and we're going to talk in our next lecture, this is a paired set of lectures, a little bit more about some of these food sensitivities and metabolic disorders. Some of these include anaphylactoid reactions, some of these metabolic disorders, and some of these idiosyncratic reactions. We'll deal with many of these in the next lecture in this two-part series. Some of it, as you find, in terms of foods, they'll cross categories. They don't necessarily just become an immune-mediated response. They can actually have both types of reactions. And some adverse food reactions are extremely hard to classify. We just don't know exactly what is going on in terms of the medical research. We have some hypotheses in terms of the mechanistic pathway of this reaction, but some of these are complex and often cascading or complement reactions that cause numerous different interactions and reactions throughout the organism. In terms of food aversions, this is where, and you may have seen this around children, I just don't want spinach. I don't want anything green, and they'll shake their head and feign illness. And sometimes there is an illness response to a food, perhaps because of a psychological linkage, negative psychological linkage to that food. As it does turn out, in terms of double-blind testing, and this is extremely important in food reaction research, when they do double-blind testing with food aversions, it's not necessarily the food product itself or any of the chemical makeup, but it's the presentation of the food, the psychological impact of that particular food, perhaps associated with a negative experience, and so we're unable to really mimic or duplicate those responses in a controlled, blinded study. Now, in terms of one of the categories of food allergy, we have hypersensitivity. This is the classic range of food allergies. These are immune-mediated reactions, and so in a certain sense, we have to learn a little bit about the immune system in terms of its response to the proteins and chemicals in food that might elicit this response. It can be triggered by very small amounts of food, and so in classic food allergy, a little is enough, and so in terms of individuals with food allergies, they really have to be on their guard, not only for the small amounts of the food product that they are allergic to, but also potential cross-reactivity with other proteins that may have similar reactions but not come directly from that food. It does occur on the second exposure, or again to a cross-reacting antigen. Again, an antigen that presents from another food product that is close enough in structure and function to elicit the same immune response. Some of the outcomes are anaphylaxis and some sort of cutaneous reactions. You've seen hives, rashes, bumps, itching, histamine-based reactions. These are very common food allergy reactions. In terms of the history of food allergies, in ancient times, the early Greeks and Romans actually did observe some food allergies. Hippocrates documented milk sensitivity almost 3,000 years ago. In 1921, a group of researchers injected a normal person with a fish extract and got no effect. They followed up with injecting the serum of a sensitive person and then the fish extract and actually saw an allergic reaction. And so this was the first observation of this sensitization, the two-stage aspect of food allergy. It wasn't until 1966 that researchers discovered the role of IgE as this immune mediator antibody that was important in allergic reaction and the main, perhaps, biological response to allergy. In terms of the epidemiology of food allergy, we find that it affects about 6% of children less than 3 years old. A lot of these allergies are milk and soy-based allergies. The prevalence in these young children has a lot to do with immature gastrointestinal tracts, the inability to digest certain components, certain proteins, milk proteins. Cow's milk food allergy is about 2.5% of the population. Mostly about 80% of individuals that do have a cow's milk intolerance or allergy resolve that by about their fifth birthday. Egg allergies, and this is primarily with albumin and some of the proteins in eggs, about 1.5%, and again, these children have about 85% resolution by their third birthday. Peanut allergy is about 0.5%. There is a clinical tolerance that can be reached in some small minority of individuals. There is some epidemiological observations out there that peanut allergy may be increasing in children, this might be a result of an increase in sensitization or the prevalence of these peanuts and peanut oils in products that are fed to younger children or allowed just in the food system in general. It might also be that we're getting better at diagnosing it and recording the instances of this particular food allergy. In terms of food allergy, there is really only a small subpopulation at risk, in total less than 1%. As it turns out, there is a familial linkage, perhaps hereditary. 65% of susceptible people have close relatives with allergy. There is some response in terms of potential for increased intestinal permeability. Some of these have to do with diseases prior to the development of allergies, some viral gastroenteritis, some cystic fibrosis, or premature birth is a predisposition factor, a risk factor for food allergy, as well as something generally referred to as leaky gut syndrome, where there is passage of proteins typically from the gut into the intestinal cavity and therefore potential immune-mediated response. In terms of food allergy, it is higher in children with other atopic disorders. Atopy is a classic sort of series of allergic type reactions. These individuals have eczema, dermatitis, sometimes tremendous amounts of allergies. We find food allergies prevalent in these individuals. 35% of children demonstrate food allergies that are atopic. About 6% of asthmatic children also have this. And so individuals that are set up in terms of their IgE levels or general immune status and are predisposed to food allergies. Adverse reactions to food additives, about 0.5 to 1% of children. And so again, these are not huge numbers in terms of a predominant sector of the population of children, but this is a significant amount. And again, because the outcome of food allergy can be fairly dramatic and uncomfortable, this is something that physicians do monitor. The pathophysiology of the whole presentation of allergens in the food system goes as such. What we find is the GI tract forms a barrier to the outside environment. You've got to remember that food and the intestinal flora, there's an epithelial lining in there. The gut-associated lymphoid tissue actually protects us from the bacteria that's inside that comes in our food system in terms of normal consequences of eating, as well as our intestinal flora. What we find is that in food allergy, the gut-associated lymphoid tissue does inhibit responses to non-dangerous antigens, but it has the ability to mount a response to pathogens. And so it's this detectability in terms of upset stomach or pathogens or food poisoning, microbial food poisoning, that we have this selective response. We typically will refer to this in terms of the non-responsiveness as oral tolerance. And so many of these proteins, many of these marker compounds that perhaps will, in some cases, lead to food allergy in normal populations will be demonstrate oral tolerance. Pretty much what we find in food allergy is that the intact food antigens actually will penetrate the GI tract and not necessarily cause clinical symptoms. What we do is, predisposed individual, when we have oral intolerance failure, we'll have an immune-mediated response and therefore a food allergy. Well, hypersensitivity is broken down into four basic immune-mediated allergic responses. This helps us categorize or simplify the full range of the immune system and its response to allergens. Of these, type 1 and perhaps type 4 are the most important in food allergy, although all of these take part somewhat in the whole range of food adverse food reactions. In type 1, we refer to this as immediate sensitivity. This is an IgE-mediated allergic response. We have this because there's a failure in oral tolerance that does lead to some excessive food-specific IgE antibodies being developed. These bind on many cells, and these cells include the basophils and mast cells being cells that reside primarily in connective tissue, and they have a tremendous immune responsibility. I have a diagram here of a generalized cartoon of what a mast cell has. They typically have granules inside. These granules contain many of the immune-mediating substances, such as histamine. What happens is that IgE binds to the surface, and these IgEs have an antibody reaction with an allergen, and that stimulates a progressive degranulation of the mast cell and release of some of these, a cascade of these compounds such as histamine. This is a good thing because of potential for example, parasites and other infectious processes. But in fact, when you really think about this, this immune response is actually coming from a small chemical or a protein or an antibody relationship, not necessarily life-threatening. And so from an evolutionary biology point of view, researchers are struggling with why exactly this particular system exists in terms of this cascade of effects, this allergic reaction. What is it really protecting us from? Why are we having a life-threatening, potentially life-threatening response to a chemical that perhaps in and of itself is not life-threatening? And again, this goes back to the potential history of parasites in the human organism. What we find is that the food allergens will penetrate the mucosal barrier, and then bind with these IgE antibodies that have been pre-sensitized to that particular allergen, and then you get this cellular mediator release. In terms of the endpoints of this release of type 1 hypersensitivity, you'll get cutaneous responses, hives, urticaria. You can see here in the picture, those of you that have ever had a hives type reaction know this well. Welts, rashes of various kind, flushing, GI impacts in terms of lip, tongue, or palate itching and swelling, laryngeal edema in terms of the windpipe becoming somewhat hard to breathe, and in some cases vomiting and diarrhea. So a full range of potential responses, focusing on the dermal aspects and the GI tract aspects. In terms of respiratory responses, we find in terms of upper respiratory, itching of the eyes and tearing, some nasal congestion, running noses, typical allergic reactions for those of you that have allergies. In terms of lower respiratory tract, bronchospasms, wheezing, in terms of generalized aspects of the full course of a dramatic food allergy, you may end in generalized anaphylactic shock, which needs to have active treatment. It can be life-threatening. The next type of hypersensitivity reaction is a non-IgE-mediated class called type 2 antibody-dependent cytotoxicity. In this particular case, we've got an antibody that binds to the surface of a tissue, something like a red blood cell, and it introduces a cascade response referred to as complement activation. There's an immune cascade that, in fact, releases these inflammatory mediators, leading to some tissue damage. This is one of the types of immune reactions associated, for instance, with transplant rejection. It's also associated with milk-induced thrombocytopenia, where there is a destruction or a removal of thrombocytes from the blood system. Another class of non-IgE-mediated allergic reactions, hypersensitivity reactions, are antigen-antibody complex-mediated. And this leads, again, to a complement activation or a cascade of immune-mediated chemical responses, a fairly complex reaction. It's been implicated in food-related complaints. We find these complexes in the sera of normal patients. It's more commonly found in patients with food hypersensitivity. In terms of the relationship of these complexes to food disease, this has been a challenge in terms of medical research and drawing a line of connection between the observation of these complexes and food allergy, separating them out, if you will. The fourth class of hypersensitivity is type 4 cell-mediated hypersensitivity. It also is a non-IgE-mediated. This is the classic interaction associated perhaps with some delayed hypersensitivities like celiac disease. There's a relationship of immune cells like CD4 plus T lymphocytes, and there's a promotion of reactions of many of the immune-mediating chemicals. It's likely to contribute to a number of GI disorders, and what we find is that there can be a tremendous cascade of immune response and perhaps even tissue lesions associated with these reaction sites in the gut. In terms of cell-mediated hypersensitivity, the cutaneous aspects of this are associated with contact dermatitis and the formation of blistering on the skin. Some of this is extremely dramatic. If you search around some of the dermatology sites and the food allergy sites, we can have GI tract sensitivity in terms of enterocolitis, proctocolitis, and also enteropathy of the upper and lower GI tracts. In terms of respiratory tract, what we find is there can be a pulmonary condition referred to as Heiner syndrome. It's an interalveolar bleeding essentially a fluid passage in the lungs, and you can imagine that this is not a condition that should be ignored, obviously. In terms of mixed IgE and cell-mediated, what we find in terms of allergic endpoints, we can get atopic dermatitis in terms of dermal impacts, GI tract inflammation associated with allergic response, and some respiratory disease such as asthma. In terms of a summary for IgE-mediated food allergy, we have a progression of events that typically starts with the production of IgE antibodies. These bind to the surface of mast cells or basal cells. We then have a second exposure to an allergen. So we have a pre-sensitization, and then we have a full allergic response. This is why physicians warn people that have an allergic response to, for instance, a pharmaceutical like a penicillin allergy, they mark on your charts not to give you penicillin, because the first time it might be a rash, the next time it might have significantly more severe consequences. On the second exposure to the allergen cross-links IgE on the surface of these cells. There's a release of histamine, bradykinin, leukotrienes, tumor necrosis factor. There's inflammation and swelling that follows that. This swelling is caused by some capillary leakage of local blood vessels, leaking white blood cells to the area. This gives you the inflammatory response that you've perhaps had when you've had a rash. And finally, the presentation of or cascade towards some level of allergic reaction. In the picture here, you'll see what's referred to as an epinephrine stick. This is an epinephrine injector. It's an auto-injector. Children and adults that have strong food allergies typically carry these injectors with them in response to a food allergy or food allergy exposure. In terms of the immune cell responses to an allergen, this cartoon diagrams mast cell sensitization. If we follow this across the cartoon here, we've got an allergen that's presented to a sensitized mast cell. And when I say sensitized, it means that the IgE has been sensitized, pre-sensitized to this particular allergen. There's a binding site. The binding between IgE and mast cells is significant, even though they're two separate entities in terms of where they come from in the biosynthesis system. The reaction is so strong that you can consider them to be almost permanently coating on these mast cells. There is a receptor interaction when they are exposed to an allergen. This leads to some chemotaxis and a process called degranulation in the mast cells. Mast cells are typically found in connective tissue. When this does happen, the degranulation actually explodes some of the cellular components in the granules, which contain histamine and some other inflammatory products and immune system mediators. This then cascades down and has direct impact, for instance, on smooth muscles, on tissues, on the bronchioles, and this is the endpoint allergic reaction that we experience when we have an allergy. Way to look at this as well in terms of an actual micrograph of these cells. This is the normal mast cell stained on this side, and you can see the granules within the individual mast cells. Once they've had their allergen interaction, they've been sensitized and they start releasing, you'll see a deformation and a release of the chemicals, a significant change in terms of the response of these cells to in an immune-mediated reaction. Now, the symptomology of food allergy is broad, and it depends upon the individual, the range of allergy, and the sensitivity of the individual to that particular allergen. In terms of respiratory endpoints, we find asthma, wheezing, bronchospasms, shortness of breath. In terms of cutaneous, hives, eczema, rash, and itching. GI impacts, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain. You can see inflammation, vasoconstriction, hypotension, chest pain, nausea, full range. And so it can go again from a nuisance to a life-threatening situation in terms of the range of symptoms. One of the life-threatening aspects of food allergy is anaphylaxis. Anaphylaxis can be localized or generalized, mild and annoying to fatal. It can depend upon the amount ingested and the length of time from the initial exposure and the presensitization factor. Not all symptoms are found in all people, and so this can, again, affect many people, but not everyone. Local anaphylaxis is a relatively common allergy manifestation, atopy. About 10% of the people have atopic syndrome. It's sometimes associated with certain types of individuals, hereditary factors. Light-skinned people, red-haired people typically have more presentation of local anaphylaxis. These individuals are easily sensitized to allergens, and they have cause a localized reaction when inhaled or ingested. These individuals typically have are more commonly afflicted with hay fever, hives, asthma, and other sorts of atopic diseases. It's a clustering phenomenon with a broad range of sensitivities to various allergens. Generalized systemic anaphylaxis is the one that's of greatest concern, perhaps an allergic reaction. This particular disease manifestation or allergy manifestation accounts for about one-third of all the anaphylaxis seen in emergency rooms. The symptoms include rashes and angioedema, respiratory in terms of typical sort of allergic reactions, runny nose, bronchial hyperreactivity, cardiac hypotension, arrhythmias, vascular collapse in the advanced presentation of this particular symptom. In the GI tract, nausea, vomiting, abdominal cramping, and diarrhea. There is a diagnosis in terms of systemic anaphylaxis by a history and demonstration of food-specific IgE in the individual. In terms of fatal food-induced anaphylaxis, you read about the occasional peanut allergy anaphylaxis causing death in the news media. In terms of a review of fatal food-induced anaphylaxis, in this particular review, 32 cases. Most were adolescents or young adults. There was a history of a prior reaction to the implicated food group. Only about 10% of these individuals had an EpiStick with them, and obviously it was insufficient in terms of mitigating the allergic reaction. Peanuts and tree nuts were responsible for a majority, 94% of these fatalities. And so this gives you an issue in terms of an outcome of an allergic reaction, in terms of what actually happens out on the street. Peanut allergies are probably the worst in terms of having a fatal outcome. There's another form of anaphylaxis called exercise-induced anaphylaxis, and this is somewhat rare form, and it occurs when a patient exercises a number of hours after ingestion of a specific food. Some of these offending foods include wheat, celery, shellfish, fish of various kinds, fruit, and milk. What is interesting in terms of the presentation of this allergic response. Without the exercise, the food does not have this allergic reaction. It's most common in women 15 to 35 years old. The symptoms are more pronounced just prior to menstruation. Diagnosis is again based on a history of evidence of specific IgE reactions with that particular food. In terms of the clinical medicine, how do we go about diagnosing food allergy? Usually the self or parental self-diagnosis of food allergy is wrong. We find that the food diary works significant in terms of diagnosing what the response is and correlating it to a particular food type. So the when, what, how, much diary of food ingestion and associating that with some sort of allergic response is extremely helpful. As well, there is a double-blind food challenge, the DBFC, where, in fact, neither the patient nor the doctor know if the placebo or the allergen is in the food product, and monitoring for reaction. In terms of laboratory medicine or clinical medicine, the skin prick test, many of you have been tested for allergies, may have gone through a skin prick test at the allergist's office, and also a radio-labeled antibody test called RAST, R-A-S-T. In the skin prick test, what we do is try to find out in a very quick assay to determine if IgE is involved. It's a preliminary test. What we do is apply allergens to the forearm, to the back, a large surface area. There's a scratching of skin to kind of make sure that the blood and the allergen are mixed. An inflammation that occurs is diagnostic for an allergic response. The inflammation will result from histamine and edema following an allergic reaction. There's a positive control used in this in terms of putting histamine as one of these skin prick tests. For those of you who have done this laboratory, this office visit test, you'll note that you go in for your skin prick and there's an array of allergens. Sometimes multiple visits are required in terms of doing the whole range, perhaps dozens of these chemical compounds, to adequately diagnose the range of allergies an individual might have. The other test is called a radioallergoadsorbent test, or RAST, R-A-S-T. What we do is we test for IgE and IgE levels, and then we apply a crude extract of allergen to a solid phase in a tissue culture plate. When you add the patient's serum, there is a reaction of the IgE to the allergen. There's a binding reaction. And then we add an anti-IgE to this radio-labeled antibody, and we measure the binding in this particular laboratory trial. And this gives you an idea of whether or not we do have an IgE reaction for that particular allergen. Some of the common allergenic foods in infants and children include cow's milk, as I said, it's the most common, eggs, legumes, including peanuts and soybean, and wheat are associated with the most common food allergies in children. In terms of common allergies, food allergies for adults, we find peanuts and soybeans in the gross category of legumes, shrimp, crab, and lobster. Clams, oysters, scallops, fish of various kinds via histamine contamination quite often. Tree nuts, eggs, and wheat in terms of the presentation of celiac disease. Food allergens aren't necessarily just one compound in a food product. As it turns out, many multiple proteins occur in a food substance, and each one can have a selective reactivity in terms of an allergic response. Some of the protein allergens in milk, we have casein, lactoglobulins, lactoalbumins. In terms of food processing, there is no reduction in milk allergens by pasteurization, condensation, evaporation, or drying. So the food allergy will present for a significant range of dairy products. For egg allergies, the allergen is the ovalbumin, conalbumin, and lipoprotein associated with eggs. Egg white appears to carry more of the proteins and therefore more allergenic response. Again, there's no reduction even with the adulteration of some of these proteins by cooking. In peanuts, some of the protein allergens have been identified as arachidin, lectin reactive glycoprotein, and a protein called peanut 1. These are also very heat stable, and that's why you find peanut allergies associated with peanut oil, even peanut oil that has been used in frying and high temperature cooking. Trace sensitivity is a significant factor associated with peanut allergy. In fish, we find an allergen referred to as allergen M. It's a common protein in fish. It's a muscle protein called parvalbumin. These proteins are conserved in most fish species. They're very cross-reactive from species to species. Again, very stable in processing. And so if you have a fish allergy, this is typically the allergen of greatest sensitivity. In terms of the broad range of allergenic proteins across the food system, not many of these specific compounds have been identified. As it turns out, peanuts have about 30% protein. There's a wide variety of proteins involved in many food products. In soybeans, it's about 42% protein. It is difficult to isolate specific moieties. Some of the groups that we find in terms of hypersensitivity reactions, albumins, lipoproteins, globulins, glycoproteins, and various S fractions associated with food products. And so it typically may not just be one compound, but a range of compounds in a food product. In terms of the ones that we have somewhat identified and followed up on, cow's milk, we find beta-lactoglobulin as being one of the allergens identified. In egg yolk, it's lipoprotein. In peanuts, it's peanut 1. In soybeans, glycinin. Codfish, allergen M. In green peas, it's albumin. In rice, it is a glutalin or globulins. And in tomatoes, it's glycoproteins. And so for some food allergies, there has been follow-up analysis of specific proteins involved. In terms of food allergens in various food products, you hear references to chocolate sensitivity, to strawberry sensitivity, perhaps citrus as well. Some of these do not show positive often on double-blind studies, and so there's some question on the actual mechanism of the adverse food reaction in terms of some of these particular products. It could be the way the test is designed. It could be idiosyncratic responses in the individual. These are food allergies that are hard to document in terms of clinical study. Well, to follow up and to finalize here in terms of the treatment of food allergy, I think hopefully I've impressed on you that food allergy for many individuals is a very serious situation, a very serious condition. In some individuals can be life-threatening. Total avoidance of a specific allergen is the best, leads to the best outcome. Typically, because of prior sensitization and the potential for anaphylactic shock, no level is necessarily considered to be safe. Very small doses can elicit a response, a cascading immune response in food allergy. And this is different from other sorts of food sensitivities where perhaps eating or drinking a small amount of the food will perhaps lead to a little GI upset, a little discomfort, but not the cascade of events that is associated with food allergy. With people with true food allergies, cross-reactivity among the different allergens is a constant worry. Not only in terms of the food types that they know, but food types exploring new foods, going out to restaurants, perhaps traveling and being in less control of what you eat and the ingredients in a particular food product. Well, this gives us, at least for today's lecture, a little bit of an introduction to the overall concept of food allergy as it presents as a disease manifestation in food toxicology. What we'll do next time is take a look at some of the metabolic disorders and the idiosyncratic and sensitivity disorders associated with the adverse reactions in food. Until that time, we'll see you then. Bye-bye.